still in the middle of slide 8, because you were talking about the 6 major functions performed by membrane-bound proteins. We've already gotten through A and B. Signal transduction is next, and transduction, which is the noun form of transduce, means to convert from one form to another. For instance, a loudspeaker is often called by hi-fi nerds a transducer because it converts the AC signal into movement of the speaker cones. In a cell, signal transduction refers to a signal causing something to happen that is going to serve as a second signal, and so on. Like handing a note off to someone, and your job's done, but they have to deliver it to someone else. We've already talked about chemical signals, and what's the important thing that you should remember about chemical signals that I've said multiple times? What do you know about chemical signals? How do they work?
Set into a protein.
Right. They serve as ligands, right? So they don't do anything unless they bind to a receptor of the right type, a receptor that has the right shape to receive them. This is why signals that are sent all over the body, hormones are like that because they're put into the bloodstream and the whole body gets the blood, they won't have any effect except at certain tissues that have the right kind of receptors to know that they're there. Well, chemically speaking, there are 2 major kinds of signals when we're talking about hormones, that is. Some of them are lipid-based and some of them are amino acid-based. And most of them are amino acid-based. They're proteins or small peptides, smaller peptides than proteins. But anyway, they're too big to get through the phospholipid bilayer directly. Lipid-based hormones, like the steroids, they can actually go right through the phospholipid bilayer. We talked about the things that are able to get through before, right? Lipid-based hormones find their receptors inside cells or even inside the nucleus, but not the protein-based hormones. They can't get into the cell because they're too big, and so they more or less have to just knock on the door to deliver their message. And that's what's shown here in this cartoon. So the purple thing is the receptor protein. The orange thing is whatever signal. And if that signal is present, then this receptor, because it has the right shape for that kind of signal, will allow that signal to bind to it. And you already know what the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein is, right? What is that? What happens in general when any kind of ligand, whether it's a signal or a substrate or any other kind of ligand, what happens when it binds to a protein? Yeah. Exactly. There is a conformational change in the protein. The protein changes shape. Well, that is how signal transduction happens. I mean, that has to be true for signal transduction to work, because this signal, the orange thing, cannot get into the cell. When it binds to this receptor, the receptor's shape is going to change. Now, if this were not a transmembrane protein, and hopefully you recognize that it is a transmembrane protein based on that definition, but if it were not, then it would be facing outward, but it wouldn't stick all the way through the thickness of the membrane, right? And in that case, when it changes shape, nothing inside the cell would know that happened, right? But since it is a transmembrane protein, when it changes shape in response to the signal binding, that will include a shape change to the part of the protein that is facing the interior of the cell. And now, all of a sudden, it can interact based on that new shape with things inside the cell. In other words, it can pass the message on to something else that we call the second messenger. And that can cause something else to happen, and there can be several things happening in sequence, and eventually there is the ultimate effect of the signal. But the first signal, the original signal molecule, is causing something to happen inside the cell without actually entering the cell, but only if that protein is there. If the tissue does not have the protein that recognizes that signal, then it won't know that hormone's there and it won't have any effect on it. Okay, D is cell-to-cell recognition, which is very important in a multicellular organism like we are. A unicellular organism doesn't have this problem. A unicellular organism is one cell, so any other cell is a foreigner. But in a multicellular organism, it's important for the various cells of that organism to recognize each other as belonging to that one organism. In other words, to be able to recognize the difference between self cells and non-self cells. Not all non-self cells are dangerous necessarily, but they can be. It's important for the organism to recognize self cells and, in other words, I mean, for one thing, it's important so that they don't destroy cells of the same organism. Right? So that involves two different proteins in this case. A protein embedded in the plasma membrane of one cell and a different protein embedded in the plasma membrane of a different cell of the same organism. And this is where I was talking about those ID badges. The sugars of this glycoprotein, or the sugar component of this glycoprotein in the one cell, is like a little ID tag that is able to be recognized by this other cell because the top protein in letter D recognizes the shape of that sugar, that ID badge. So it says, okay, you're one of us. I'm not going to destroy you. Intercellular joining in E is kind of similar. It involves membrane-bound proteins in two different cells, but it's not about recognizing each other as being a member of the same organism. In this case, it's about holding these cells together. So this is exactly what desmosomes do that I mentioned earlier. And then finally, F, I've actually already talked about this as well, attachment to the cytoskeleton extracellular matrix. This is what I was talking about when I was talking about strain relief. If something tugs on this outside of protein, which is attached to the membrane-bound protein, it's not just going to yank this out or potentially rupture the plasma membrane and kill the cell, because on the other side, it's anchored to the proteins of the cytoskeleton inside the cell. So it protects the membrane from rupture. Now, 9 isn't actually new information, but it's the best picture we've had of this thing that I've talked about several times, namely the movement of membrane material from one organelle to another. Right? So what we have here are vesicles that are formed by budding off of membrane material from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because the rough ER is done with its job, which is modifying some proteins, packages them in a piece of membrane of itself. That's where these vesicles are formed. And those are then received by which end of the Golgi complex? What is the... Yes, the cis face receives these vesicles. Well, it's made a membrane, so membrane just kind of melds into membrane, and that will put these now modified proteins into the Golgi. The Golgi figures out where they need to go and then creates brand new packages using membrane from itself. That's what this vesicle is. And so the cargo here are these newly modified proteins. Well, when this vesicle then fuses with the plasma membrane, the membrane material is now part of the plasma membrane. But notice what's happening here. Some of these proteins are in the vesicle, are completely inside the vesicle. But notice this dumbbell-shaped one is actually embedded in the membrane of the vesicle. And that makes a difference, because now when this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, which is the process of exocytosis, the proteins that are fully inside the vesicle get spilled completely out of the cell. They get exocytosed. And that's appropriate because these cells need to work outside the cell. But the dumbbell one, which was part of the vesicle membrane, is now part of the plasma membrane. So that's how the cell, that's how the Golgi, part of its determination of where things need to go. If it realizes that this is a protein that needs to be embedded in the plasma membrane, it will put it in the vesicle itself, in the membrane of the vesicle, not inside the hollow part of the vesicle. And it'll end up in the plasma membrane. The reverse of this happens as well. So when a cell wants to take something out of its plasma membrane, it will form an infolding, an in-pocketing, or an invagination via endocytosis, and that vesicle that comes into the cell is just a way of getting stuff out of the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane is always changing its composition from moment to moment. Well, you might recall that we've already talked about 10, 11, and 12 down in the lab. Just remember, that's important for up here, too, in the exam, but I'm not going to go through that again. And so that'll bring us to 13. We're looking at a unicellular organism here. More specifically, it is a unicellular protist. Now, if I told you what the word protist means, nowadays at least, it's kind of a unofficial name in a sense. A protist is any eukaryotic organism that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Animals, plants, and fungi, of course, belong to eukarya, so they're eukaryotes. But they're not the only members of eukarya. If you can count all of the other members of eukarya besides animals, plants, and fungi, those collectively are called protists. Some of them are huge, like there's brown algae, for instance, that are as big as trees. But some of them are unicellular. This is a unicellular protist. And more specifically, it's an aquatic unicellular protist. What do I mean by aquatic? It is true that aquatic things live in water, but it's more specific than that because marine also means living in water, but the two are different. What's the difference between aquatic and marine? If they both mean living in water, what could the difference be? No, they're both living in water. I mean, yes, they are, of course, made of water, too, like all organisms. But the difference is that aquatic... Go ahead.
I don't know. I was going to say that one, like uses water as oxygen.
That would be true of both. The difference is that aquatic means living in fresh water, lakes and rivers, whereas marine means living in salt water, ocean. And based on what you learned in the time that I downstairs talked about tonicity, the slides I just skipped, that's a hell of a difference in environments, right? If you live in freshwater versus saltwater, totally different environments. Well, it would be no big deal for a bacterium to live in freshwater, because a bacterium typically has a cell wall, like a plant cell does. But this aquatic protist, unicellular protist, is an example of a cell that doesn't have a cell wall. It's like one of our own cells, like the red blood cell in the picture I showed you. It has a plasma membrane, of course, like all cells do, but no tough exterior outside of that. So, this is a precarious situation, because what is the tonicity for this, of the environment for this organism? It's what? I can't hear what you're saying after HYP.
Hypotonic.
You're hypotonic? Yes, it is hypotonic. Fresh water is hypotonic, meaning it's... What does that mean with respect to solutes? It means it's more watery because there's a... Hypotonic means a comparatively lower solute concentration in the environment than in the cell. But more watery is the more direct way of saying that, which means water, which is always going to want to move to where it's less watery, is always going to be wanting to move into this cell. But it's a cell that has... no way to withstand the pressure, right? It will explode. It would explode just like a red blood cell of our own body would explode in a hypotonic environment. Well, you can lose a red blood cell without noticing it. In fact, you can lose many millions of red blood cells without knowing it. But if you lose a cell, a single cell, as a single-celled organism, you're dead. So it's a big deal to lose one cell if you only have one. It doesn't die, though, despite living its whole life in a hypotonic environment and no cell wall to withstand the pressure, because it has this specialized organelle called a contractile vacuole. It's made out of membrane, just like any vacuole is, but it's equipped with those actin microfilaments that we talked about as part of the cytoskeleton. Remember, those are involved in deformations, and so they are how your muscles work. So what happens here is that the water by osmosis comes into the cell, but it also goes into the contractile vacuole, and the contractile vacuole swells up. When it stretches to a certain size, that's what causes these contractile proteins, just like in your muscles, to work, and that squeezes on the contractile vacuole and pumps out the water. So it acts kind of like a little heart. It acts as a pump, getting rid of the stuff that's coming in, the water that's coming in continuously. Keeps it alive. Now, in 14, we need to start talking more about transport processes again. Or continue talking about transport processes, because we've talked about some things down in the lab already. Who wants to remind us of the three major categories of processes that can move things into or out of cells? Yeah.
Passive
transport and active transport are two of the three. What's the third one?
Vesicular transport.
And vesicular transport is a special case in a sense. It's kind of like a cheating mechanism, because if a vesicle is used, then whatever it is being transported either into or out of the cell actually never passes through a membrane. That's different from the other two. In passive transport and active transport, both of those, whatever is being transported actually directly goes through the membrane. But there's two ways that you can get through a membrane. You can get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, right? We've talked about this, haven't we? What has to be true if something's going to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer? Exactly. If it's small and nonpolar, then it has no problem slipping right past these equally nonpolar tails. So that's... those are the things that do not need the help of a transport protein. What we're looking at here in purple are transport proteins. But that's kind of misleading, because there's other kinds of transport proteins in the sense that they move things around inside the cell, like the motor proteins we talked about. When we're talking about transport proteins here, what we really are referring to are transmembrane transport proteins, meaning proteins that are specialized in working for the purpose of transmembrane transport, meaning transport through a membrane either into or out of the cell. So the reason that we need these is because some of the things that a cell has to get into or out of itself are either too big, too polar, or both. And the answer to that is a transport protein. Well, functionally speaking, there are two major categories of transport proteins, and that's what are shown here in A and B. We have so-called channel proteins and so-called carrier proteins. And hopefully it makes sense to you that any transport protein has to be a transmembrane protein, right? It has to stick all the way through the thickness, or it's not going to work to get whatever it is into or out of the cell. The big difference here is that a channel protein, and we're looking at a cutaway view here, is a polypeptide that has a hollow interior. So it forms a little tunnel through the membrane of the cell. Even though it's an open channel, it is still specific. Only certain kinds of things can go through that channel. But still, though, it is an open hole. And whatever it is that goes through it could go through in either direction, since it's just a tunnel. But what is going to determine the direction in which it goes? What's going to determine whether the thing goes into the cell or out of the cell? Right, the direction of the gradient. And so you can see in the picture, just barely, that there's a higher solute concentration outside the cell compared to inside. Therefore, a gradient is in place. And the gradient, remember, is the tendency for diffusion to occur. But there also has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. In this case, the way for it to get from A to B is the channel protein. If the gradient were reversed, higher concentration inside, then they would leave through the channel protein. A carrier protein, on the other hand, has a closer involvement. It's not simply an open tunnel. Instead, a carrier protein operates by changing its conformation. And so whatever the particle that is being moved with the help of a carrier protein is, that's another example of a ligand. These yellow molecules are ligands in this case because they are binding to the protein, the carrier protein. And so once again, the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein is a conformational change. But in the case of a carrier protein, it changes the shape such that it opens it up into the other end, the other side. In this case, it's open outward first, and then it turns into opened inwards and drops them off inside the cell. That's a carrier protein because it carries it in a sense, since it's temporarily bound to the particle being transported. Yeah.
Is it just like opens and closes?
Yes. But the reason it does is because of the binding in the solute. If there's no solute of the right type, this will just stay open and do nothing. The thing that's changing its shape is the fact that there's a binding of the correct kind of solute to it. Okay, now, while I'm still here in this slide, I want you to make sense of the fact that if you have a channel protein, then the only kind of transport it can help you with is passive transport. Because it's just an open hole, right? The direction of travel of the particles is purely going to be determined by the gradient, and those particles are going to go down the gradient. Whether that's into or out of the cell depends. Active transport moves things against their gradient. Well, if you have an open hole, things are just going to leak down their gradient, they're not going to be able to be forced against their gradient. On the other hand, a carrier protein, since it temporarily binds to the particle, it can be used either for passive transport or active transport. If it's used for passive transport, as it is in this picture, it's still passive transport, which means the thing that's causing that transport to happen is the gradient. So the reason that these things are coming into the cell is because there's a higher concentration outside. That's still passive transport, and therefore that's the source of energy. There's no need for an external source of energy. But a carrier protein can also be used with an external source of energy to grab those things and move them against their gradient. In other words, take them from where they're already a low concentration and put them into a place where they're already a high concentration, moving them exactly in the opposite direction compared to what they would like to move by diffusion, in other words. All right, you can't do that with a channel protein because it doesn't grab onto anything. But you can with a carrier protein because carrier proteins do grab on. Okay. Now we can go to 15 and look at an example of a carrier protein operating via active transport. Now, when a carrier protein operates passively, it's just called a carrier protein. It's passive transport still. But if it's working for active transport, we give it a special name, which is pump. So when you hear the word pump with reference to a cell, you're talking about an active transport protein, which will not be able to operate unless you give it the required energy. It'll be like having a water pump and not plugging it in. It's not going to do anything. You have to give it the energy. This is just one example of a pump. It's actually two pumps in one because it pumps two different kinds of particles. This is the sodium-potassium exchange pump because the two things that it pumps are sodium ions, Na+, and potassium ions, K+. It's called an exchange pump because it pumps sodium ions in one direction and it pumps potassium ions in the other direction. You have quadrillions and quadrillions of these in your body. Every cell has many, many, many of these in its. Every living cell in your body has a bunch of these. And they're pumps, which means they have to be powered. Now, often the source of energy is ATP, as it is here. It doesn't have to be ATP, but it often is. But these things are operating continuously your entire life, quadrillions of them running all the time. Each cycle, which is what these steps represent, one cycle, each cycle, which takes a fraction of a second, requires a fresh ATP molecule. And so by some estimates, this accounts for 40% of your total energy budget. 40% of the reason you have to eat is just to keep these pumps continuously running for your whole life. What's important about pumps is that since they move things against their gradient, pumps create and maintain gradients. In other words, the reason that a gradient is there is because the pump created it by stockpiling the particle on one side of the membrane versus the other. That is a gradient if that happens, right? If you put most of them on one side, then you have a higher concentration on that side and therefore a gradient. Pumps create and maintain the gradients. Well, how this one operates is that it pumps sodium ions out of the membrane, and you can't tell the gradient, but the normal gradient, because they didn't draw it right, but the normal situation in your body is that there is a higher sodium ion concentration in the extracellular fluid compared to the inside the cell. And it's just the opposite for potassium. There's a higher potassium ion concentration inside the cell compared to out. But this same pump does both of those things. So
sodium is able to bind to the... This is a carrier protein, remember. All pumps are carrier proteins.
But if it's using ATP, then it's specifically a pump.
But anyway, when this happens, it's going to, at the expense of ATP, deform in such a way that it drags sodium out of the cell.
I say drags because there's already a high concentration outside. You just don't see them. So it wants to come in. The pump is forcing more out. And then potassium from the outside, which is already scarce, most of the potassium is in here, so it's trying to leave, gets dragged along inside. So it's a double pump. And then it goes back to, if more ATP is available, meaning that you're still alive, then it will keep doing this over and over. Yeah.
So you said that's in every living cell?
Every living cell has millions of these, and you have trillions of cells that are alive in your body. So you have trillions of millions of these.
But is there like a possibility that your cells are living, but those don't do its job or they don't work?
Well, if they don't, then you're in trouble, because the goal of this pump is, it's not really that the cell wants the outside to be high in sodium and the inside to be high in potassium. The reason that pumps operate to produce these gradients is because of something that I've told you was an important thing to keep in mind about gradients. What did I tell you about gradients in the lab to not forget? Yes, I said that any gradient is a stored form of energy and therefore can be put to use doing something useful. That's why the cell does this. Not for the gradient itself, but so then it can take advantage of that gradient as a source of energy to do something for the cell, like bring something into or out of the cell that it couldn't otherwise. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if they pump at the same time, or do they take turns?
Well, it's the same pump. It's just,
when it's open this way, it grabs onto sodium, and then when it drops those sodiums off,
it will grab potassium and then come back to its original shape to bring those potassiums in, and then go back to sodium over and over.
That's literally what it looks like?
Well, I mean, it's not purple, and that's a cartoon, but yes, that's what it's doing. And all of the other copies that you have in your cells are doing that at the same time. Okay, so that's a pump, an active transporter. Let's look at this summary slide in 16. Passive transport is diffusion, right? Diffusion is always passive, and net diffusion is never going to happen unless there's a gradient. Well, these purple ones show you that for some things that are small and nonpolar, the gradient allows for diffusion directly through the phospholipid bilayer because they are small and nonpolar. Others, though, need the help of a transport protein. And if it's the gradient that's causing this, and there is no need for external energy, then it is still diffusion. But for the triangles and the blue spheres, whatever those are, this diffusion is called facilitated diffusion. Facilitated simply means helped. It's diffusion helped by a protein. The protein does not provide any energy. It's the gradient that's causing the movement. It's just that they can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, so they need to be facilitated by a transport protein. It could be either a channel or a carrier. On the other hand, if you want something to be transported against its gradient, in other words, pumped, then you have to use a carrier protein, and you have to supply energy to do that. And therefore, we call this particular kind of carrier protein a pump, because it's acting for active transport. Now, in 17, we're looking at an example of another pump. We have plenty of these pumps in our body as well, not nearly as many as the sodium-potassium exchange pump. That's the main animal-type pump. Plants, on the other hand, don't use sodium-potassium exchange pumps. They use this mostly, which is a proton pump. But you have these in your kidneys, for instance. What is a proton? A hydrogen ion. So proton, hydrogen ion, H plus, all mean the same thing, remember. And that's why you have all these H pluses. Those are the protons. It's a pump, as you can clearly see, because ATP is being used to power it, for one thing, but also because it's moving these protons out of the cell, which is against the gradient, because there's already a higher concentration of protons outside than in. Right? That's why they're being pumped. You have to force that to happen. So this is what we would usually call active transport, but I'm going to call it primary active transport, just to distinguish it from secondary active transport, which we'll look at next. But anyway, the plant is not doing this because it wants protons to be outside the cell. It's doing this because creating this gradient can then be used. Gradients are useful things. Right? Just like, you know, if you put the energy into carrying water uphill, it can pay off for you if you dump that water onto a water wheel, which will turn, and it could grind your corn or whatever, do whatever the turning of the wheel does, right? That's the payoff, using a gravitational gradient in that case by dumping it downhill. But anyway, this is primary active transport. That's easy to understand. It's a little trickier to understand what's in 18. Well, in 18 we have exactly the same proton pump that we just looked at. That's operating via primary active transport as well. But we have another protein right next to it in the membrane, this so-called sucrose proton co-transporter. And before I talk about how it operates specifically, I need to give you some more definitions. Some transport proteins, and this is whether they're pumps or not, okay, any given transport protein either transports just one kind of particle or it transports multiple kinds of particles. Now, when I say one kind, that doesn't mean one particle. There can be millions of particles, but they're all the same type. The proton pump is a good example of this. Only protons go through this. Any transport protein that transports just one kind of particle is called a uniporter. And the process would be called uniport. All right? Uni means one, obviously. But then there are also co-transporters, which are proteins that operate for co-transport. Co means share. A co-transporter more or less simultaneously moves two different kinds of particles. And that's a general word. That's all it means. Two different kinds of particles being moved. Doesn't say how or where. There's two ways that this can happen, though, fundamentally different ways it can happen. A co-transporter can move two things in the same direction as each other, and that can be either both into or both out of the cell. They're the same thing with respect to categorizing them. And those would be called symporters, because sim means together, and the process would be called symport. Or a co-transporter can move the two different particles in opposite directions. And in that case, that co-transporter is called an antiporter. So what do we have here for the sucrose proton co-transporter? That's a symporter, exactly. What about the sodium-potassium exchange pump? That's an antiporter because it moves them in opposite directions. Okay, now this sucrose proton co-transporter that we're looking at, and this is a plant cell, same plant cell as before. This is also a pump. And all I have to say is pump to for me to mean that it's operating via active transport, right? That's what pump always means. Well, you can't really tell it from the picture because they didn't draw enough things. But this is a pump because even though it's not shown, the sucrose concentration is already high inside the cell. It's lower outside the cell. But sucrose, more sucrose, is being brought into the cell. So sucrose is being dragged against its gradient, and therefore it's being pumped. Okay? But this pump is operating for what we call secondary active transport. Now notice that there is no ATP molecule being spent on this pump. Nevertheless, it's a pump, so there has to be an external energy source. There's no way around that. What is the energy source in this case? What is it that is powering this co-transporter pump? Exactly. The proton gradient is the source of energy. All right? So the proton pump on top is working directly spending ATP. That's why it's primary active transport. The external energy source is directly used. That creates the proton gradient. The proton gradient would not exist if this proton pump were not running. So you spend ATP, which is using some energy, but you're putting that, you're investing that energy in a different form. This stored form of energy now is the gradient itself. The gradient is the tendency for protons to diffuse down their gradient, right? Once you have the gradient, the protons want to go back into the cell down their gradient. They want to diffuse. Well, they're plenty small. Protons are not even as big as an atom. But they are fully charged. They're ions. So they can't easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, even though they want to. It's kind of like turnstiles. You have a huge crowd of people trying to get into the ballpark, but they can only go through the turnstiles, right? That's what this co-transporter is like. So that's what they do. The only places they're allowed in, they do diffuse in through those co-transporters. So from the viewpoint of the hydrogen ions, the protons, they are passively moving into the cell. They're diffusing into the cell, right? But the only way they can do that is by binding to the co-transporter to get down their gradient. And when that happens, the co-transporter drags the sucrose along for the ride against its gradient. That's how the proton gradient is forcing the pumping of the sucrose. And that's why we call it secondary active transport. Because the source of energy is a gradient that's established by a pump earlier. It relies on that pump, which in turn relies on the ATP. All right, that's 18. Let's go to 19 and look at vesicular transport. We've talked about vesicular transport and seen pictures even, but let's review the terminology first of all. Vesicular transport is an umbrella term. That's real general. That simply refers to any movement of a particle into or out of the cell using a vesicle. But what are the two major categories of vesicular transport? Based on the direction of the travel of the particle. Correct. Endocytosis and exocytosis. those words only indicate about which way the particle is traveling. So on the top, you have endocytosis, because this brown thing is outside originally. It comes in via a vesicle. This is what I meant by a cheating mechanism. This brown particle gets into the cell, but never actually goes through membrane. It's just that the plasma membrane wraps around it, pinches off. Now the vesicle's inside the cell, but the brown thing never went through membrane. That's fundamentally different from passive and active transport, right? Well, anyway, this is endocytosis, because it's coming in. Exocytosis we saw in that previous picture, where the dumbbell-shaped protein was embedded in the membrane and the other ones got spilled outward. That's exocytosis. We can then divide endocytosis into two major categories based on what kind of thing actually gets endocytosed. What were those words? Right, we see these here. This is phagocytosis, as it's labeled, which means cell eating, because the thing being endocytosed is a solid chunk. It's the same process if it uses endocytosis to bring in a little sample of the liquid exterior. It's like taking a sip, though, so it's pinocytosis, cell drinking. Other than that, it's basically the same process. And some cells are just more or less continuously undergoing pinocytosis. They're basically just taking a sip of the environment over and over, not really knowing what is there that they're sipping. Other cells, though, don't bother taking a sip unless the thing that they want to take into themselves is there. And that's why you have a special kind of endocytosis here called receptor-mediated endocytosis. So these red Y-shaped proteins that are membrane-bound, they're part of the plasma membrane, have a specific shape, like receptors in general do, that only the right kind of thing will fit into. So they are there, always at the ready, to detect the sudden presence of the thing that the cell wants to take in. If it's not there, nothing will happen. But if it's there, and it being the purple triangles here, then it will bind to the receptor. That causes a change in the receptor shape, and that signals the cell that the thing is there. It's time to form a vesicle, an invagination of the plasma membrane to form a vesicle, and that will bring the thing in specifically the thing that it's trying to take in. That is the chapter, and therefore is the unit. So don't forget a Scantron when we're upstairs next time, but I'll see you in the laboratory before that. Unless you have questions before I turn off the recorder. You have any questions for the unit? Okay.